Welcome. You're listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Materials or items read on Ayers Allais are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Hello, this is Roger Baker, and welcome to this podcast of articles from Sky and Telescope, brought to you by Ayers Allais. Today's articles are from the April 2025 edition. In today's podcast, we'll be taking a look at News Notes, which are various news articles from the world of astronomy. Next, Lyrids pulse in April. A sprinkle of late-night meteors arrives mid-month. Written by Bob King. Next, High and Low Moons. Written by Bob King. Next, Alphard and the Golden Branch. Slip into the night sky's infernal region with Hydra the Water Snake. Written by James O'Meara. Next, Black Holes from the Dawn of Time. Black holes created in the earliest moments of cosmic history might explain multiple mysteries. Written by Camille M. Carlyle. Next, Inspirational Stargazing, a book review by Jamie Herndon. And finally, From Lahore to Toronto. A Toronto-based artist recounts his astronomical journey alongside his global journey. Written by Julian Samuel. And now, on to today's podcast from Sky and Telescope. News Notes. Inner Planets. Ancient Venus didn't have oceans after all. Astronomers have conducted a long and fierce debate about whether Venus was always a dry hellscape with oven-like temperatures. Now, as published December 2, 2024 in Nature Astronomy, three researchers from the University of Cambridge, UK, offer support for that idea. Of two rival theories of Venus's past, one argues that Venus was once temperate and hosted oceans of water, enough to cover the surface to a depth of 500 meters or 1,600 feet. But then, more recently, volcanoes released vast quantities of carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide, greenhouse gases that trapped the sun's heat. The water first evaporated, then escaped into space. Alternatively, Venus may always have been too hot and dry to support liquid water. Teresa Constantino and her colleagues utilized the Venusian atmosphere, largely the product of volcanic gases from within the planet, to probe the interior and examine how dry the planet really is. The team calculated the current rate at which water, carbon dioxide, and carbonyl sulfide, COS, molecules are destroyed in the planet's atmosphere. They also considered chemical reactions occurring between Venus's air and surface, weathering that can cause these molecules to be stored in the planet's crust. Constantino and her team conclude that Venus's volcanic gases are at most 6% water. This implies the planet's interior is too dry to ever have brought large quantities of water to the surface. This is an intriguing study, says James Holmes, who was not involved in the research. However, he adds, there still remain uncertainties that are likely to influence the results, such as the precise chemical composition of the deep atmosphere and the current rate of active volcanism. Not everyone is convinced by these new calculations. They make two assumptions that I would question, says Richard Gale, who was also not involved in the research. Their assumption about Venus surface weathering is, I suspect, wrong. If the team overestimated the amount of carbonyl sulfide and carbon dioxide that chemical reactions deposit into the planet's crust, then there would be fewer of these molecules relative to water. Then, to keep the atmosphere in balance, the amount of water ejected from the planet's interior would need to be higher than the team estimated. I think they also significantly underestimate the importance of the sulfur cycle, Gale adds. For example, as sulfur-rich minerals break down on the surface, carbonyl sulfide could be put back in the air, providing another way to shift the ratio of that molecule relative to water. The team admits the story for sulfur is more nuanced. Perhaps it will take future missions, including NASA's Veritas and Da Vinci and the European Space Agency's Envision, to settle the debate on Venus's past once and for all. Icy rivers may have flowed on ancient Mars. Mars is a frozen desert world, enshrouded in an atmosphere too rarefied for liquid water to flow on the planet's surface. Yet the planet's landscape is replete with ancient river networks and other signs of water-based erosion. Peter Buehler explores the connection between these valley networks and the polar ice caps in November's Journal of Geophysical Research, Planets. Around 3.6 billion years ago, as its atmosphere thinned, Mars could no longer efficiently transport heat from the warmer equatorial regions up to its poles. Carbon dioxide gas over the poles froze and fell to the ground, building up caps of CO2 ice on top of water ice. Buehler proposes that this carbon dioxide ice acted like a heavy thermal blanket, trapping the planet's internal heat and melting the base of the water ice sheet. The meltwater snuck out in ice-encased rivers that oozed like solid-crusted lava flows, Buehler explains. From the South Pole, these rivers could have wound their way equatorward, spilling into Argyre Planitia, an impact basin roughly the size of the Mediterranean Sea. Excess water overflowed that ice-covered lake and then meandered northward again, perhaps draining into equatorial plains thousands of kilometers from the pole. This scenario would explain several geologic features that scientists have observed in these parts of Mars, Buehler says. Anna Grau-Galafri says that, at least as far as the larger valleys in the South Circumpolar region are concerned, Buehler's scenario is provocative but plausible. But she's skeptical of larger-scale implications for valley networks closer to the equator. The strength of this idea is that we know the phenomenon of atmospheric collapse occurs, says planetary geologist James Head. But can it have such a major effect? Fortunately, the hypothesis is testable. Both Head and Buehler say these tests include more detailed analyses of geologic features and computer modeling of global climate processes, efforts that could enable scientists to link specific features to model predictions with more confidence. Asteroid Belt. New view shows surprising number of small asteroids. A new analysis of archival James Webb Space Telescope data, published online December 5th in Nature, reveals that small asteroids in the main asteroid belt are more numerous than thought. The finding could change calculations of the impact rate on Earth from such bodies, which range from 10 to 500 meters or 30 to 1600 feet across. Larger main belt asteroids, whose orbits are between those of Mars and Jupiter, tend to remain in relatively stable orbits. However, gravitational interactions more frequently perturb smaller objects, which might then enter the inner solar system to become potential impactors. The high number of small objects now found in the main belt, at least five times more than expected, could affect calculations of the frequency of such impacts. Artem Burdanov and colleagues used a shift-and-stack approach, often used to provide images of faint, fast-moving objects in the solar system. Usually, this process involves precisely tracking an object with a known or presumed orbit. Dozens or even hundreds of digital images added together can then allow an object to emerge from the random background noise that changes from frame to frame. But without knowing the orbits of Webb-detected targets, which were found as foreground objects in archival images of the TRAPPIST-1 system, the team used a brute force variation on shift and stack, looking in every possible direction with reasonable velocity ranges for potential moving targets. The initial blind search produced more than 1,000 candidates. Burdanov and his colleagues then narrowed these down and confirmed 138 previously unknown asteroids, as well as 8 known ones. Because the infrared thermal energy emitted per unit surface area doesn't vary much among objects in the asteroid belt, the astronomers could determine the diameters of Webb's discoveries to within 10 to 20%. These results open the prospect of mining similar JWST datasets, enabling an improved census of various asteroid families. Team member Richard Benzel says, "These asteroid findings fill an important knowledge gap for tracing the source of meteorites and larger potentially hazardous asteroids in Earth's vicinity." Exoplanets. Transiting planet found around infant star. Planets form within disks of dusty gas encircling newborn stars, disks that tend to shield those planets from view. Now, astronomers have detected a still-forming planet, thanks perhaps to a stroke of luck that flipped the obscuring disk out of the way. The youngest planet previously found by the transit method, in which a planet dims its star's light while passing in front of it, was about 10 million years old, long enough for most of the dusty disk to have cleared. The new planet, found with NASA's Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, TESS, and cataloged as IRAS-04125+2902b, is only about 3 million years old. The discovery is published in the November 21st Nature. Until now, it wasn't clear that planets could form so quickly. While a handful of such young planets have been found via other methods, they tend to be far more massive and moving in wide orbits. The new planet was only detectable because its star's large outer dust disk is oriented almost perpendicularly to a sparse inner disk in which the new found planet orbits. The star is part of a widely separated binary about 520 light-years away in Taurus. At first, the team thought that the pull of the companion star might have warped the disk, but the secondary star orbits the primary in the same plane as the newfound planet and the inner disk. Instead, it's possible that another star flipped the disk as it passed close by, says study leader Madison Barber. However, she adds, that's not something we can really test. Alternatively, the outer disk may have been warped due to surrounding gas falling in along another plane. TIDY-1b, as it's also known, is almost the size of Jupiter and orbits its star every 8.83 days. Yet it has less than 30% of Jupiter's mass, perhaps having lost its outer layers in the face of the young star's winds and radiation. It might end up as a sub-Neptune, a type of planet common in the galaxy, but absent in our solar system. Follow-up observations of this young example may shed light on these planets' evolution. Webb Telescope Reveals Featherweight Giant Planet. Every new young transiting planet is a valuable target for planet formation scenarios, which is why, for several hours in February 2023, the James Webb Space Telescope turned its attention to what was thought to be an infant-hot Jupiter called HIP-67522b. But the new observations, published in December's Astronomical Journal, show 17-million-year-old HIP-67522b looks nothing like the giant of our solar system. If the planet had a Jupiter-like mass, its gravity would have hugged its envelope of gases closer. Instead, Webb's observations indicate the atmosphere extends farther out than expected. The puffy atmosphere came as a surprise to the team, led by Pachia Thau, who suggests the planet must have a much smaller mass than anticipated. Further analysis of the atmosphere's thickness by these researchers implies that HIP-67522b equals roughly 14 Earths. This makes it one of the least massive giant planets ever discovered, and more similar to sub-Neptunes than Jupiters. Although sub-Neptunes are absent from our solar system, they're one of the most common types of planets in the galaxy. Astronomers think they might lose their initial gaseous envelopes through processes that include star-induced boil-off. HIP-67522b's low current mass likely dooms it to this fate. It's probably already losing its atmosphere at a prodigious rate, and most of it will be gone in the next billion years. All that will be left is the shrunken core. Measuring the atmospheric properties of young planets provides a unique opportunity to understand the formation and evolutionary histories of these planets, says Manaza Alam, who was not involved in the study. Placing constraints on atmospheric escape early on in a planet's lifetime can help us better understand the processes at play that sculpt their atmospheres. Kuiper Belt. Distant Makemake might have a hotspot. Despite its distance from the Sun, the far-flung Kuiper Belt object, 136472 Makemake, is warmer than expected, leading to some surprising conclusions. Averaging 45 astronomical units from the Sun, and with a brightly reflective methane ice cover, Makemake should have a mean surface temperature around 40 Kelvin. Some 15 years ago, observers indeed found such cold temperatures across most of the body, which spans 1,430 kilometers, or 900 miles, but something on, or near it, registered as significantly warmer. Now, observations from the James Webb Space Telescope have revealed that some portion of Makemake is even warmer than previously realized, prompting new explanations. The study, led by Sabek Hiss and published November 20th in Astrophysical Journal Letters, combines JWST measurements with those from the Spitzer and Herschel Space Observatories and the ground-based Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array to view Mach Mach's emission over a broad range of wavelengths. According to Kiss's team, the best-fit scenario involves a small patch, as little as 20 kilometers across, of something very warm by Kuiper Belt standards, 150K, or minus 195 degrees Fahrenheit. The source, they suggest, could be a hotspot, a cryovolcanic flare-up piping heat from the warmer interior. Another set of JWST observations provides circumstantial evidence for this possibility, revealing that the methane ice on Mach Mach's surface has less heavy hydrogen, or deuterium, than expected, which could result from recent chemical reactions with water. Alternatively, Kiss and his colleagues suggest that a dark ring could match the observations. Rings aren't unusual, even around small solar system bodies, but the particles circling Mach Mach would have to be both unusually small and have an unusual carbon-rich composition for the explanation to work, and the ring's orientation would have to be just so to have avoided detection when Mach Mach occulted a star in 2011. Kiss and his colleagues point out that the two explanations aren't mutually exclusive. Perhaps the purported cryovolcano erupts tiny carbon-rich particles along with its cryolava, particles that encircle Mach Mach as a dark ring. In brief, Parker's closest approach to the Sun. NASA's Parker Solar Probe flew by the Sun in the first of three close and closest approaches that will complete the primary mission. The 22nd perihelion on December 24, 2024, took the spacecraft 6.2 million kilometers, or 3.9 million miles, from the solar surface, about 9 times the Sun's radius, breaking previous record approaches. Since the 8th close pass in April 2021, the mission has truly been touching the Sun, as it flies through the part of the solar atmosphere dominated by our star's crackling magnetic field. NASA's Stereo-A and the European Space Agency's Solar Orbiter, observing from near-Earth vantage point, provided a wider context for the Parker data. The mission's perihelia are now occurring during the peak of activity in solar cycle 25, so the observations provide a comparison for data collected during the Sun's quieter years. Project scientist Nawar Rawafi says the team is planning a proposal to extend the mission for years to come. Proba 3 launches to study solar corona. The European Space Agency's Proba 3 rocketed to space on December 5th. Built to provide views of the solar corona, this is the third spacecraft of a series designed to test new technologies while also carrying scientific instruments. The spacecraft will operate into two parts, dubbed the Occulter and the Coronagraph. A 1.4 meter wide or 4.6 foot disc on the Occulter will cast a shadow onto the coronagraph's instrument package. For this to work, the two spacecraft must fly 150 meters or 500 feet apart while maintaining their separation to within a few millimeters. In this formation, Proba 3 will image the corona as close as 1.1 solar radii from the Sun, providing the closest view we have right now. The LASCO C2 camera aboard the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory can only image as close as 1.5 solar radii. Proba 3's view won't be constant, though. The paired craft have an elongated 19.7-hour orbit and will only conduct observations during the 6-hour window when they're farthest from Earth. Proba 3's instruments will provide insights into the solar corona, solar wind, and the Sun's total power output. Lucy's second Earth flyby. NASA's Lucy spacecraft passed by Earth on December 12th and 13th during a gravity assist maneuver that will help to propel it to the outer solar system. As part of its mission to explore 11 asteroids, Lucy is primarily intended to explore the two camps of objects that circle the Sun in dynamically stable locations on either side of Jupiter. The Greek camp, located at Jupiter's L4 Lagrangian point, ahead of the planet on its orbit, and the opposing Trojan camp at the L5 point behind Jupiter. Getting there takes some complicated orbital gymnastics, including 3 Earth flybys. This one was the second of those. The first occurred in 2022. December's flyby increased the spacecraft's velocity relative to the Sun by 7.3 kilometers per second, or 16,000 miles per hour. At its closest approach, the spacecraft was only 360 kilometers or 220 miles above our planet's surface, whizzing by at 14.8 kilometers per second relative to Earth. This flyby followed Lucy's visit to 152-830 Dinkanesh and its satellite Salam in November 2023. Now, the spacecraft is headed to the main belt asteroid 52246 Donald Johnson, named for the discoverer of the Lucy hominid fossil, and will pass 922 kilometers or 573 miles from it on April 20, 2025. LIRID's pulse in April. A sprinkle of late-night meteors arrives mid-month. Written by Bob King. One of my favorite signs of spring where I live is the sound of water dripping from the roof while I'm out with the telescope. When the night temperatures stay above freezing, the snow remaining on the roof continues to melt into the evening, making a pleasant drip, drip, drip as the stars come out. Along with water droplets, birdsong, and the year's first leaves, spring also brings the ever-reliable LIRID meteor shower. Although associated with Vega, the brightest star in the constellation Lyra, the celestial lyre, the display's meteors actually hail from across the border in Hercules, a reminder of a time when constellation boundaries were more fluid than they are today. Earth enters the LIRID stream, the dusty spawn of Comet Thacher, C-1861-G1, around April 14th, and exits at month's end. The shower is at its best during the early morning hours of the 22nd, when the radiant approaches the zenith. That's also close to the time of maximum, which is predicted to occur around 9:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. LIRID rates vary from an all-time maximum of 90 meteors per hour to the more typical 15 to 20 per hour. Although the northern hemisphere is favored, southern observers can also enjoy the display, though at reduced rates due to the radiant's lower altitude. Fortunately, the moon won't be a serious problem this year. It rises as a 36% illuminated waning crescent at around 3:30 a.m. local daylight time, roughly an hour before the start of morning astronomical twilight for observers at mid-northern latitudes. LIRID viewing is easy. Simply dress warmly and set up a reclining chair where you're least troubled by neighborhood lights. The direction you face doesn't matter since the meteors can flash anywhere in the sky. You can start as early as 9:30 p.m. on the evening of the 21st, but you'll have more success when the radiant stands higher later that night and into the pre-dawn hours of the 22nd. You'll undoubtedly see an occasional sporadic random meteor, but LIRIDs stand apart because their paths can be traced back to Vega. Need more incentive? Let's add a couple of planets to the deal. Stay up to dawn and welcome Venus and Saturn, low in the southeastern sky and less than 5 degrees apart. If you have a telescope, you can be among the first to glimpse the south face of Saturn's razor-thin rings, tipped just 1.6 degrees. The last time anyone got a gander at this side of the rings from Earth was back in 2009, after that year's ring plane crossing. High and low moons. Like all of us, the moon has its highs and lows. Every month, it reaches a northern extreme in easternmost Taurus and dips farthest south in Sagittarius. Over the past year, you may have noticed that those extremes have been, well, more extreme than usual. The moon doesn't strictly follow the path defined by the plane of Earth's orbit, the ecliptic. Because it circles our planet at an angle tipped by 5.1 degrees, the moon can appear significantly above and below the ecliptic. During an event known as a major lunar standstill, that 5.1 degree tilt adds to the ecliptic's 23.4 degree inclination. When that occurs, the moon reaches declinations significantly north of the summer solstice point in easternmost Taurus and south of the winter solstice location in Sagittarius. Major standstills happen every 18.6 years. The current one began in 2024 and continues through most of 2025. The next major standstill takes place in 2042. When the tilt of the moon's orbit is opposite to that of the ecliptic, 5.1 degrees is instead subtracted from the high-low solstice points, and the moon's declination range reaches a monthly limit of 18.3 degrees north and south. Such a minor lunar standstill happens in 2034. The moon's orbit intersects the ecliptic at two points called nodes. The sun's gravity perturbs the Earth-Moon system, causing the nodes to migrate westward, clockwise when viewed from above Earth's north pole, every 18.6 years. During a major lunar standstill, the ascending node, where the moon crosses the ecliptic from south to north, is near the celestial equator in Pisces. 2 weeks later, the moon reaches its highest point above the ecliptic. Then it loops south, crosses the descending node, and dips into the lowest point below the ecliptic. Not only does a major standstill dramatically affect the moon's altitude, it also impacts its rising and setting points. The sun's declination, its distance north or south of the celestial equator, has an annual range of about 47 degrees, from 23.4 degrees north to 23.4 degrees south. By comparison, the moon's monthly range is currently closer to 58 degrees, causing its location along the horizon to shift noticeably north or south as successive moonrises and moonsets. On the night of April 3rd, the thick lunar crescent tops out at the Taurus-Auriga border with a declination of some plus 28.5 degrees. Then, on the morning of April 18th, it scrapes the bottom at about minus 29.5 degrees in Sagittarius. Enjoy the roller coaster ride! Alphard and the Golden Branch. Slip into the night sky's infernal region with Hydra, the water snake. It's spring in the northern hemisphere, time for life to push up from the ground after a long winter sleep. Orion, the hunter, long a symbol of winter, will be near setting in the west. Virgo, the virgin, an ancient fertility goddess, rising in the east, and the Big Dipper upside down in the north, pouring its life-giving waters onto the thirsty earth. Much of the southern sky, however, breaks the celebratory air as it offers us prime viewing of a mythological realm of the dead. This region of cosmic gloom has only one stellar beacon, second magnitude Alphard, the alpha star of Hydra, the water snake, usually female in ancient times. A line from Gamma Leonis through Regulus, both in the Sickle of Leo, the lion, points directly to Alphard. Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe called it Cor Hydrae, meaning Hydra's heart. The name refers to the star's location in the creature's body, but we can also watch the golden-hued star pulse with the vagaries of our churning atmosphere. This month, as seen from mid-northern latitudes around nightfall, Alphard lies at its highest, burning in a well of darkness, a vast visual realm of largely inconspicuous stars. The well is capped by three prominent alpha stars, 0.4 magnitude Procyon in Canis Major to the west, first magnitude Regulus in Leo to the northeast, and first magnitude Spica in Virgo to the east. The placement of these stars all but covers the length of the water snake, which resides in the dark well. We can visualize the triad of bright stars as the points where Poseidon, Greek god of the sea, struck his trident into the rocks of Lerna to create a spring in honor of Amymone, a water nymph he loved after saving her from a satyr. The spring ended a drought in southern Greece, but became the lair of multi-headed Hydra, whom Hercules was sent to overcome in his 12 labors. Now, let's imagine our celestial well of darkness as the Lernaean spring where Hydra resides. It would fit right in with the legend of Hydra, as popularly linked to the labors of Hercules. But the spring of Amymone was also envisioned as the gateway to the underworld, where Hades, its king, ruled over the souls of the dead. In Book 6 of Virgil's Aeneid, the Trojan hero Aeneas consults the Sibyl, the oracle of Apollo at Cumae, a Greek colony near Naples, Italy, and begs the prophetess to guide him into the underworld so he can meet his dead father's ghost. At this moment, Thomas Bulfinch recaps in The Golden Age of Myth and Legend. With horrid clang, the brazen gates unfolded, and Aeneas saw within a Hydra with 50 heads guarding the entrance. Usually, the Hydra would attack any unwary traveler with poisonous venom, but the Sibyl told Aeneas that, here, the Hydra was only a ghost and could not harm him. In order to pass safely into the underworld, however, Aeneas had to first break off a golden bough from a tree in a neighboring grove and bring it as an offering for Proserpine, queen of the underworld. After handing the bough to Charon, the underworld's ferryman, the Sibyl and Aeneas were allowed to cross the Styx, one of the rivers of the underworld. We can now look upon Golden Alphard as the Golden Bough, and the sinuous form of Hydra as the River Styx. Hydra lies close to the gateway to the celestial underworld, the point where the celestial equator and the ecliptic intersect. This is where the sun dies each year as it slips from north to south in its annual journey, and the long periods of darkness begin for those of us living in the northern hemisphere. Contributing editor Stephen James O'Meara has been studying the star and their lore for more than 50 years. Before we go on, you're listening to a recording for the blind and print impaired. Material or items read on Airs LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Black holes, from the dawn of time. Black holes created in the earliest moments of cosmic history might explain multiple mysteries. Written by Camille M. Carlyle. Sown throughout the universe could be an invisible landscape of cosmic gopher holes. These primordial black holes would, physically speaking, be just like the black holes we find elsewhere. Spots so dense that space-time has effectively swallowed itself and created bottomless pits. But unlike the objects made from dead stars and other normal matter, primordial black holes would have formed in the earliest moments of the universe, back when everything was a hot, dense soup. Scientists first proposed the existence of primordial black holes in the 1960s and 1970s. Speculation soon arose that the objects could be the gravitational glue holding things together, the long-sought dark matter, the invisible stuff that serves as the backbone of galaxies and cosmic structure. But primordial black holes remained a fringe topic, eclipsed by dark matter candidates from particle physics. Over the years, their popularity waxed and waned. Research papers trickled in at a rate of several dozen to a few hundred per decade. Since 2016, however, these objects have enjoyed a surge in popularity. The sudden fandom stems from the detection of gravitational waves, ripples in the fabric of space-time created by accelerating masses. Most of the gravitational wave events we've detected come from merging black holes. The suggestion that the first event found might have been the collision of two primordial black holes brought what had been a field in perpetual twilight into the bright light of day. In the most optimistic scenarios, primordial black holes could explain part or all of the universe's dark matter and some gravitational wave events. Recent work even suggests they might serve as seeds, not only for the supermassive black holes planted in the centers of galaxies, but also for the galaxies themselves, explaining unexpected sightings in the early universe. Within a decade, enthusiasts say, we might finally have firm evidence for primordial black holes, if they exist. From the Cosmic Stew. Back when the universe was a fraction of a second old, it was filled with matter and radiation. This plasma was not perfectly smooth. It had knots of higher density in random places. As the nascent universe expanded, the plasma soup diluted and cooled. Dense knots naturally expanded more slowly than the surrounding diffuser stuff. Under the right conditions, some knots could have packed enough mass into the right amount of space to stop expanding, overcome their internal pressure, and collapse, creating black holes. To overcome the plasma's pressure takes special circumstances, explains Bernard Carr, who has worked on primordial black holes for some 50 years. Collapse could happen if the smallest density fluctuations were more severe than the ones on larger size scales that later gave rise to galaxies and cosmic structure, fluctuations we see in the cosmic microwave background, the afterglow from this early era. Or collapse could have happened during a phase transition. At certain moments in the primordial universe, conditions change dramatically akin to when liquid water freezes. During these transitions, the pressure dropped. A region that otherwise wouldn't be dense enough to collapse suddenly might. The primordial universe experienced several phase transitions. At each epoch, knots of a certain mass and size were most likely to collapse. The smallest primordial black holes, those squeaking in at 10 to the minus 5 gram, about one-tenth the mass of a hungry flea, would have formed at the Planck time, 10 to the minus 43 second after cosmic history began. Larger black holes would have formed later. A spurt would have occurred at 10 to the minus 5 second during what's called the quantum chronodynamics, QCD, transition, Carr says, when subatomic particles called quarks combined to create things like protons. Black holes formed at this time would have most commonly had a mass roughly equivalent to that of the Sun. Only a tiny fraction of the universe would have collapsed to make these objects. Anne Green, who has spent her career exploring solutions to the dark matter problem, is skeptical that conditions could have been so precisely tuned to make exactly the right number of primordial black holes at the right time, such that they could explain dark matter. Too many too early, and they would upset the balance between radiation and matter. You've got to get the perturbations just right to make all of the dark matter primordial black holes, and not to have created a universe that just made the primordial black holes and nothing else, she says. The smallest primordial black holes would have evaporated away long ago. In fact, it was studying their hypothetical quantum properties that helped lead Stephen Hawking to discover that black holes evaporate. The temperature of an evaporating black hole's radiation is inversely proportional to its mass. So, as a black hole shrinks, it heats up. those still evaporating today would have a mass of 1 quadrillion grams, or 10 to the 15th power gram, or the mass of a small comet packed into a space a little larger than a proton. Such black holes would radiate gamma rays, albeit slowly. They'd sit sizzling away over billions of years, Carr says, before losing their remaining mass in an explosion of gamma rays. Gamma rays do suffuse the universe in a high-energy haze from a variety of sources. To stay within the limits set by this haze, at most, 1/1,000,000,000th of the universe's total contents could be made up of primordial black holes of comet-like masses. An endless sea of nothing? Primordial black hole, PBH enthusiasts split on which mass should be the target of ongoing searches. Some, including Carr, favor a solar mass, while others focus on objects as lightweight as planets and asteroids. The first potential evidence seemed to support stellar mass objects. In 1977, astronomers reported their results looking for dark matter in the form of massive compact halo objects, MACHOs, in the Milky Way. They stared at 8.5 million stars in the Large Magellanic Cloud and watched for blips created by unseen objects in the Milky Way's halo passing between us and the stars. These transits temporarily magnify the background star's light, a phenomenon called gravitational microlensing. The MACHO team detected more microlensing events than they expected to see if the only things passing between Earth and the LMC were stars and their ilk. The researchers estimated that perhaps half of the Milky Way's dark matter halo could be in the form of objects with roughly half a solar mass. "We were really excited," Carr says of himself and his fellow enthusiasts, when they heard the result. Half a sun was a good match for the mass expected from the QCD phase transition. We thought, wonderful, PBHs really exist. Not only did they have dark matter density, they had the right mass. Subsequent analyses with more data and studies by other microlensing projects drastically reduced the fraction of dark matter that could comprise such objects. But the analyses had shortcomings, which gave enthusiasts hope that the window wasn't quite closed as tightly as it seemed to be. Then, in 2016, scientists with the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGO, announced they detected 2 black holes merging. The black holes each weighed in at about 30 solar masses, bigger than any star-made black holes known at that time. They also fell into a potential mass range for PBHs. Simeon Bird and others suggested that the black holes might have been primordial and could have merged after catching hold of each other in a flyby encounter. A universe filled with 30 solar mass PBHs at a density high enough to match dark matter's effects could lead to a merger rate consistent with that inferred from the single LIGO discovery, the researchers calculated. Physicists were primed to take interest. The most favored candidate for dark matter, weakly interacting massive particles, or WIMPs, had failed to materialize. LIGO coincided with the time when people were considering a broader range of dark matter candidates, Green says. The convergence led to a swell of interest. Carr now gives talks about PBHs at particle physics conferences. He admits feeling a bit odd about it. "When I'm talking to these people, I think, my goodness, if the dark matter is primordial black holes, I'm going to be the most hated person in the room." Because it's saying these people have spent all their lives looking for something that isn't there, he explains. On the other hand, that's the nature of science, isn't it? Most models are wrong in the end anyway. Many enthusiasts hold tight to the PBH explanation for gravitational wave events, Carr says. If you go to a PBH meeting, and now they have PBH meetings, it's all more or less assumed that some of the gravitational wave events are going to be primordial black holes. Nevertheless, the idea has never become mainstream. You can definitely make all the black holes that we have observed so far from astrophysical formation channels, says LIGO astrophysicist Sylvia Biscovenu. Subsequent work showed that if dark matter comprised primordial black holes in the 30-ish solar mass range, we'd be detecting mergers far more often than we do, Carr adds. Attention has turned to lower masses, of a few suns or less. When massive stars die, their cores become neutron stars or, if they're big enough, black holes. The cutoff should be around 2.5 solar masses. Stars struggle to make black holes with masses slightly above that cutoff. We know of only a handful of examples, and they shouldn't make any black holes below it. If gravitational wave detectors find a merger involving at least 1 black hole lighter than a solar mass, then the object should be primordial. So far, scientists with the LIGO, Virgo, and CAGRA projects, united as the LVK collaboration, have not found a single sure merger with an object this small. Even if they did, it would be challenging to definitively show that the object was a black hole and not a neutron star. Biscovenu says, "Neutron stars are somewhat squishy, a trait that will leave a weak imprint on the gravitational wave signal if the star merges with something of comparable mass. But to have any hope of seeing this effect, we need to find a merger of two lightweight objects within a few hundred million light years of Earth. That's local by cosmic standards. So far, nearly every event has lain much farther away." LVK is currently in its fourth observing run, set to end in June 2025, and analysis of the many dozens of mergers detected during this run is underway. But in considering events from previous runs, Zuxing Chen and Alex Hall concluded that stellar mass PBHs cannot make up most of the universe's dark matter and can at best explain roughly one quarter of detected gravitational wave events. It is a recent microlensing result, though, that has many ruling this mass range out completely. In 2024, astronomers with the Optical Gravitational Lensing Experiment, OGLE, reported the result of 20 years of monitoring some 79 million stars in the Large Magellanic Cloud. Based on the number of microlensing events they detected and the event's duration, which is related to the lensing object's mass, the researchers concluded that compact objects in the mass range of about 0.0002 to 6 suns cannot make up more than 1% of dark matter, and objects ranging from 1 times 10 to the minus 5 sun, equivalent to Neptune, to 860 suns cannot compose more than 10% of dark matter. Thus, primordial black holes in this mass range cannot simultaneously explain a substantial fraction of dark matter and gravitational wave events, Zemek Meraz and colleagues concluded. "The beauty of microlensing is that it's a fairly clean thing," says Green, who wasn't involved in the study. "You should be seeing it. You don't see it." Carr and his colleagues wonder whether some of the OGLE team's assumptions could be skewing the result. For example, primordial black holes' natural propensity to cluster might mean that the OGLE results aren't quite as definitive as they appear, because our sightlines could be missing clusters. But even if the OGLE results do mean the solar mass window has slammed shut, Carr remains unfazed. "It doesn't bother me too much, because if this argument is correct, that just means, okay, we're forced to another scenario where the PBHs are at a lower mass." Piddling black holes. Given these results, many enthusiasts are investigating primordial black holes of planetary or asteroidal masses instead. Here, scientists have few observational constraints. Some even suggest we might have already detected signs that PBHs exist in this range. The conditions in the early universe that made primordial black holes would also naturally have created gravitational waves, explains Guillaume Dominich. These waves would exist as a background noise in the universe today. This noise could be the same as the gravitational wave background recently detected by comparing the arrival times of signals from pulsars scattered across the sky. The background's properties correspond to conditions that would have made primordial black holes similar in mass to Jupiter, he says. However, so far, there's no sign of black holes with these masses among gravitational wave events. Using LVK data up through late 2019, Andrew Miller and others found no evidence of planetary-ish mass PBHs within the Milky Way's stellar halo. "It is unlikely that such objects could make up all of the dark matter," Miller says. Stellar masses, similar to those of asteroids or the Moon, remain a possibility. Some have suggested this gap is also closing. If these small black holes were out there, the argument goes that inevitably encounter stars and merge with them. The primordial black hole would burrow inside the star and eat it from the inside out, transforming it into a black hole with a mass equal to that of the now-gone star. If gazillions of little PBHs were out there, then we should see a multitude of free-floating stellar mass black holes, which we don't. Recent work has refuted this line of reasoning, however. For now, the asteroid mass gap remains open. Catalysts of galaxy growth. Light of all wavelengths fill the universe with a diffuse glow. This light comes from different sources. Some we can pinpoint. That X-ray beacon comes from that black hole in that galaxy, but there's also an ambient unresolved glow. Its sources might be hidden in dusty clouds or too far away for us to see. The glow is not uniform. Astronomers have found brighter regions in the cosmic X-ray background about an arc minute across, explains Priyamvada Natarajan. Fluctuations appear in the cosmic infrared background at the same spots. The arc minute scale is intriguing. Long ago, when the universe was making its first stars, galaxy formation was proceeding on the same scale in the sky. The natural source of these bright regions would be big black holes scarfing down gas in the early universe. But standard thinking has been that the supermassive black holes we see today in galaxies' cores formed a bit later, after the galaxies did. Natarajan and her colleagues decided to explore the idea that gas-guzzling primordial black holes could produce the X-ray and infrared emission instead. For that to be the case, though, the PBHs would need to be deep in the galaxy, right from the start. So we said, "You know what? We just have to make the dark matter primordial black holes," she says. The black holes would serve as the seeds for galaxy formation, drawing dark and normal matter together to make galaxies. The biggest PBH would naturally sink to the center and grow into a supermassive black hole. The trio explored what this scenario would mean for the early universe. They found that, thanks to this early seeding, galaxies would build up earlier than predicted in standard cosmology. The team forecasted that we should see a sharp upturn in the number of galaxies in the universe's earliest years. There are hints that the James Webb Space Telescope is seeing this upturn. Astronomers have found more galaxies at early cosmic times than they expected. Some appear to be surprisingly large and evolved, implying they formed stars rapidly within the first billion years. This remarkable abundance of luminous galaxies at such early times holds the promise of upending theories of primordial galaxy formation, wrote participants of a 2024 workshop on the early universe. Finding too many galaxies at early times won't close the case on primordial black holes, Natarajan warns. Early galaxies might simply have been better at making stars than we expected, nor does every supermassive black hole have to begin as a PBH. Some seeds might start as the cores of overmassive stars, or as big gas clouds that collapse directly into black holes. Natarajan and her colleagues have found at least one object that shows all the signs of being a direct collapse black hole. But when there's more than one way for something to happen, then chances improve that it does, she says. And there's more than one way to make a primordial black hole. I'm completely open to the idea that PBH is formed in the very early universe, she says, and that some fraction of the supermassive black holes we see were seeded by them. Game changer. Proving or disproving that primordial black holes exist will be difficult. Astronomers might spot the gamma ray flash from an evaporating black hole, for example, or we might find signs in the universe's chemical makeup. The existence and evaporation of tiny PBHs in the early cosmic soup could have impacted the distribution of protons and neutrons, and even the production of atomic nuclei such as helium. Some scientists are convinced that gravitational wave detectors are going to solve the conundrum. As astronomers push out to greater distances, they're learning how the rate of black hole mergers changes with time. If the black holes come from stars, the rate should track the cosmic star formation rate, which peaked 10 to 11 billion years ago, at a redshift of 2 to 3, and has dwindled since. Mergers of primordial black holes, on the other hand, should become steadily more common as we look further back in time, and they should happen long before stars formed in the first few hundred million years. Data from the third LVK observing run show that the rate of black hole mergers increases with look-back time, but that run only reached to about a redshift of 1 or some 8 billion years into the past. The detectors might reach far enough in the ongoing fourth observing run to see the turnover. If a subset of black holes of certain masses merge more or less often than those of other masses, scientists might be able to tease the two populations apart. One of those populations could be primordial. LVK won't be able to detect individual sources much earlier than the peak of star formation, but the fifth observing run, tentatively expected to start in 2027, should turn up something else: the collective hum of countless black holes merging at early times. This hum is like the music of an orchestra, created by a specific combination of instruments, Biscovenu explains. Scientists could analyze this gravitational wave background to determine which combination of merging objects would best match the hum they hear. One combination could include primordial black holes. It's more likely, however, that answers will have to wait until the next generation of gravitational wave detectors, coming in the mid to late 2030s. These projects may be able to detect mergers as early as a few tens of millions of years after the Big Bang. If scientists find merging black holes that early, the objects won't be from stars. 10 years ago, says Carr, very few people believed in primordial black holes. Even he didn't really believe in them when he started working on them in the 1970s. He's 60 to 70% convinced now. He stresses that it ultimately doesn't matter whether primordial black holes pan out as dark matter or as a large fraction of today's gravitational wave events. Those aren't the only reasons PBHs are interesting. As long as they're somewhere, I don't care where it is or even how much it is, he says, because if they exist, that's going to be really exciting. Science editor Camille Carlisle remains perpetually caught by the gravitational pull of things related to black holes. Inspirational Stargazing, a book review by Jamie Herndon. Stargazers, Finding Joy in the Night Sky. David H. Levy, The University of Arizona Press, 2024. 174 pages, $19.95 in paperback. When's the last time you read a book about astronomy that simply celebrated the wonder of a dark night, looking up at the sky? What was the last one you read that reminded you of why you love the cosmos so much? David H. Levy's new book, Stargazers, Finding Joy in the Night Sky, might just be the book you're looking for. Levy, known for his discovery of 23 comets, including Shoemaker-Levy 9, has compiled a collection of his essays from the last 10 years or so that examine the stories of people who've made a difference in his life or an impression on him in some way. He explains in the introduction to Part 1, "Not all these people are astronomers. What unites them is not the sky itself, but their ways and feelings about the sky. Moreover, not all these people are people. Some are telescopes. Some are constellations. Some are comets." The book is divided into various sections with titles like Not How to Watch the Sky, But Why, Comets, The Night Sky Experience, and Joining the Sky with Life. Along with writing about astronomy, Levy brings in pop culture, history, literature, religion, relationships, and love, presenting a thoughtful and cerebral approach to astronomy that sits comfortably alongside the science. Everything works in harmony, and at the start of each section, he writes a short introduction alluding to what the reader can expect in the coming pages and what it means to him. Chapters within each part are what bring the book to life, and though each one is brief, the book is not a fast read. Levy's prose invites the reader to linger, and the ideas he brings up often make one stop and think or propel one to look for more information. Chapters like Go Web, Join Your Local Astronomy Club, Teachings of an Eclipse, The Christmas Star, and When Poetry Reaches the Stars contain practical advice, nostalgic musings, and lessons learned. The last chapter, Goodbye Wendy, is a beautiful tribute to his late wife and illustrates how even in grief, the cosmos was there. He describes the night before Wendy's funeral, when he and his grandson Matthew were in the observatory. Matthew saw a meteor, and as Levy asked about it, he saw a faint one as well. Levy writes, "I like to think that this minor outburst of the October Cygnid meteor shower, three meteors within a period of about 5 minutes, was Wendy's goodbye." Those interested in the story of his discovery of Shoemaker-Levy 9 won't be disappointed, as he has a chapter on that, as well as a touching one on the friendship he and Wendy had with co-discoverers Jean and Carolyn Shoemaker. Although Levy is always aware of and observing the skies above, it's clear that he doesn't let things on Earth pass him by unnoticed. While he shares plenty on astronomy and his own experiences in these pages, there's also an intimacy that builds with the reader that allows us to get to know him. We learn about the formative events that nudged Levy into astronomy and the relationships with the people who encouraged him to keep working toward his goals. By the end of the book, it feels as if we know him and not just his work or his thoughts on the stars. Stargazers is a deceptively thin volume that, at first glance, looks like you could knock it out in a night. But what you find inside is much deeper, much richer. Alongside pictures of eclipses, stars, observatories, and nebulae, there are photos of the Levys and Shoemakers together, a photo of the viewing site used by the author's local astronomy club, a sketch of the moon he drew in 1964, and more. This collection feels like a labor of love. Levy's love of the stars, his work, the people he met, and his family, and how all of this came together for him in his life. It is a book to savor and share with a fellow stargazer, and then maybe sit outside and together look up. Jamie Herndon is a writer and editor. Her love of astronomy was reignited as an adult, and she finally got to experience the magic of SpaceCap, a NASA-led program designed to inspire the next generation of explorers, when she accompanied her son in the summer of 2024. From Lahore to Toronto. A Toronto-based artist recounts his astronomical journey alongside his global journey. Written by Julian Samuel. My grandmother, Virginia Hem Raj Kahan Singh, born in 1902 in Lahore, then British India, inspired my love for astronomy. During the hot Lahore summers, my brothers and sisters and I used to sleep on the flat roof of my grandparents' house. It felt like a party, with owls hooting in the trees below. Under those coal-black nights, my grandmother would point out the constellations and planets, would giggle when she tried to pronounce Sputnik. Later, from Karachi, Pakistan, we sailed to the United Kingdom, where the starry night skies were extinguished. However, my need to see stars wasn't. In both Glasgow, Scotland, and later Warlingham, England, I fabricated telescopes with cardboard tubes and magnifying glasses. My scopes didn't work, except for once when I saw the moon jiggle into view and then abruptly float away. That two-second view of the moon stayed with me for years. It was only much later that I discovered tripods. At Trent University in Peterborough, Canada, I started taking Astronomy 101. One evening, our professor brought the class to a dark field on campus. Flashlight in hand, he pointed to various objects we couldn't see. We were charmed by him, even though he looked incurably eccentric. But I had no background in math. I feared numbers and dropped the course. That semester in English class, I read Bertolt Brecht's play, Life of Galileo. Decades passed. I didn't look through a telescope until I moved back to Toronto from Montreal. My partner lives in an apartment that has a vast view of our badly damaged urban sky. That view, along with adult high school courses in math, physics, and chemistry, brought astronomy back into my life. My numerophobia evaporated. Almost. I began hunting for telescopes and tripods. Online, I came across Ken, at the time an astrophotographer at Orion Telescopes and Binoculars in California, who did a convincing sales pitch for linear binoviewers. But which pair of eyepieces would work best? I phoned Teleview Optics in Chester, New York, to consult their experts. My call was transferred to a man who said, "Al Nagler speaking, how can I help?" Had the receptionist really connected me with the Al Nagler? This internationally renowned maker of telescopes and wide-field eyepieces kindly spoke with me for 30 minutes. We discussed the clear aperture on my newly purchased binoviewers, and in his Bronxonian accent, Nagler recommended a pair of 15mm Delight eyepieces. My partner and I became members of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, which is brimming with supportive astronomers. In general, astronomers are a welcoming bunch. One of the places we observe from is the RASC's AC Carr Astronomical Observatory, about 175 kilometers or 110 miles northwest of Toronto. And, yes, I inducted my partner into math and astronomy. She now teaches me integrals and derivatives while collimating our 10-inch reflector. Observing the night sky from the Canadian Shield, I imagine myself back in Lahore on that rooftop under the blackest sky. I speak to Virginia. "Grandma, thanks for the sky tour. Now, please take a look through this Dobsonian. Can you see the double cluster in Perseus?" To me, one cluster represents Lahore, the other, Toronto. Julian Samuel is an artist and author of the romantic comedy novel, Muskoka, in which an amateur astronomer discovers love under the stars in Canada's oldest and best-known cottage resort. If you want to learn more about Ayers LA and the types of programs we offer, follow us by clicking on any of the social media links at the top of our webpages. If you like what you see or hear, please click the like button. And that brings us to the end of today's podcast from Sky and Telescope. This podcast is for the sole use of our blind and print-impaired audience. Any unauthorized use is prohibited. I'm Roger Baker, and until next time, thanks for listening.